it was down around zero when zero Fahrenheit when they left.
Yeah, well, I've heard that the Midwest and the East is just getting socked again by very cold weather. I was here a couple of months ago and it was above freezing then.
Anchorage often gets the benefit of whatever warm cycles are sweeping through.
Yeah, it certainly does. Quite different from going a few hundred miles north and west. Mm. Even there, though, time to time they get some benefits from the warming trend below the ocean. This is still surprising me that she's survived so much snow,
well,
and yet it'd be so warm.
Shall we get underway?
Nice to meet you. I've read about you, seen your picture in some of the news releases that have been sent to me.
We're going to get the wind.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, since we adjourned yesterday, we have been joined now today by Professor Ted Chamberlain of the University of Toronto, who is seated next to Joe Jorgensen. Ted is from Toronto and a professor of English, served as an advisor to the Minister of Indian Affairs and Northern Development in Canada, and was an advisor to the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry, and is the author of Harrowing of Eden, a book about relations between white people and native people in North America. And we'll reach you later on today or tomorrow, Ted. This morning, I think we will ask Tito Naranjo to lead off, and then we will ask Tim Coulter to follow, and then Ralph Lerner, and we'll carry on from there. And remember what Tim Coulter told us yesterday: we're to interrupt him whenever we get the urge, even during his initial presentation. So, Tito, if you would carry on now, then.
Yesterday I decided that I should use some paradoxical intent. Paradoxical intent works like, while I was talking, I sweated a bunch. And rather than fighting the sweating, I'm supposed to use this approach. I'm supposed to say to myself, well, here's the thing to do. Put on a big show. Sweat so much that you flood the whole place, you know. Okay? Instead of trying not to do it some more, you know. And so I'll use paradoxical intent. But in case that doesn't work, I've got some tissue paper. I was talking about Pueblos yesterday, Pueblos by comparison with the native peoples up here. And I guess what I was trying to say was that the Pueblo people have a long-standing tradition of religion, long-standing tradition of dealing with governments for 440 years. And this 440 years has kind of met layering upon layering of governments. The Spanish government, the Mexican government, and the American government for about 84 years only. So that the Pueblos really dealt with the Spanish much longer than the Americans. They dealt with the Spanish for some 300 years. And so now are dealing with the Americans of late, the U.S. government. And this is very interesting because out of that begins to come some kinds of questions of, well, how does it relate to the Alaska Native situation? I can't answer that because I don't know how it relates. I know that it contrasts, you know, and I know that there are some kinds of things that stand out, at least in my mind. And in my mind, the kinds of things that stand out is that, first of all, people really fight for the kinds of things that, the values that are meaningful to them. And the Pueblos in 1680 were told not to practice their religion by Spanish priests. And they, in 1680, these peaceful people, the Pueblos, non-aggressive, non-warring, fought the Spanish, drove them out. The first message was kill the priest. And they had never done warring, but when the message for war went out to save the religion, first of all, which was a religious revolt, the people said kill the priest because they are the ones who are really undoing us. So they killed the priest. They drove out the Spanish for 12 years. The Spanish came back and reconquered. After the Spanish came back, they said, no more slavery for the Pueblo Indians. They said, you can have some land. The beginning of the reservation systems were instituted by Spanish governments. But they suffered 100 years of slavery and religious prosecution before they came across and fought a revolt and had their way. And I think that maybe that talks about survival, because the next step is that the Pueblos cannot see themselves surviving without the land. Last night I was reading Ernest Shusky, and Ernest Shusky was saying, to be sovereign is to have authority over the land. As I read that sentence, I thought, gee whiz, Ernest Shusky wrote a book in favor of the Indians, and he seems to be empathetic with the Indians, but it's not that way. To be sovereign is to have authority over the land. That's far from the truth. Let me tell you a story. In every year, I cut a Christmas tree. And this Christmas tree, we put in the house because it's American tradition, because we are also American culture. After my Christmas tree is done and used, all the Pueblos take their Christmas trees back to the river. Back to a running stream, it has to be. So, at one point in time, the game warden came up, and as I was throwing my tree in the water, he said, you're cluttering up the river. You know, I could fine you for doing this. And I wasn't about to give him Pueblo philosophy, you know, so I took my tree out of the water, put it back in my pickup, carried it to my own piece of land, and threw it back into the creek. Well, the evergreen, the Douglas fir, is one of the Pueblo deities, believe it or not. And this is what shocks American people, you know. And they think, well, what crazy thinking, you know. But the Douglas fir in the Pueblo way, along with the rain, is involved in a cycle of life with man. And this sentence really rubs me wrong, because we have no authority over the land. I think that we only exist because we are part and we are in partnership with the land. The Douglas fir, the rain that comes, where we came from, underneath the lake, this sort of thing, where we return to, this this is all integrated, and we cannot live without this kind of integration. And we have no authority over the land. It doesn't belong to us. We only come from it, from its womb. We go back into its womb, and we share life with the Pueblo philosophy really is seeking life. And seeking life is talking about very many symbolic meanings of what the land is all about, what life is all about, what the Douglas fir is all about. And I think the rest of Shusky's sentence is okay. This importance of land base is part of the feelings Native Americans have about tribal sovereignty. And I think nowadays we never thought about sovereignty. As a matter of fact, we never thought we always had governments, but we didn't think in terms of sovereignty in the sense that we now define it. I think that we only were here because we were meant to be here. Without this important integration between the land and ourselves, between ourselves and the Douglas fir, between ourselves and the cycle of rain that comes, because when the Douglas fir, the spirit is, as a matter of fact, on taking a tree, the symbolic act of pulling breath of spirit from the tree is done, and then when it's left in the river, that's done again. This kind of integration is hard for people to understand who aren't from that frame of thinking. This code that we carry in our head. I was just talking with Doric, and we're talking about. He was asking me a question, but it just occurs to me that Indians are described as dominantly right-brained people. Americans have a way of saying things, you know. And they are left-brain people, you know, analytical, and they used to say we were best for manual dexterity, you know. Nowadays, they've elevated one more, and they've said we're right-brain dominant, while they're left-brain dominant. Well, they've made things in their own image, for example, technology, and they've also made computers that are left brain. What strikes me is that American culture is a left brain culture. And, you know, specialization in everything. You just can't American culture just can't seem to stick to some kind of essence with regards to a spiritual life if there are 200 Native Americans, 200 Native Americans will have a different philosophy. But I think the one thread that runs through all of these philosophies is that the spiritual essence of connection with the land is really important. It's the essence, it's the core of life. Water and air. And if you think in terms of this left brain culture and into the future, it seems to me that one of these days when American culture, and I'm also part of that, by the way, but I'm also, I live in two worlds. One of these days when the spaceships go off and come back, I wouldn't be surprised if Americans wanting two basic things, water and oxygen, may come to the reservations and ask for oxygen, because that may be one of the last places where trees grow, and that may be one of the last places where water comes out of the ground, you know. it's becoming apparent in New Mexico as you're driving through this Espanola Valley, where connection upon connection of people are beginning to build towns. The only vacant places are Indian reservations. And I think that as populations grow, you know, this kind of sacredness, this symbol of the land is still being defined. It's being defined that, you know, it's Taos Pueblo yearly on December the 2nd through January has a quiet season, a time when the earth rests, a time when the earth is not violated, a time when people do not drive cars, a time when there is communication with the earth, and is getting back to the real essence of where all life comes from as we know it now. And I think that this is important in that, I don't know, I guess one last sentence in closing is that the left brain culture is messing around with the genetic code, you know. It may be also true in the future when the genetic code is omeletted so much that this left brain culture may come back and begin to borrow the real code from people who maybe felt, well, you know, the earth is really important, the ground is really important, it's worth fighting for. And it just seems to me that no matter how it's defined, because that problem with the Alaska Natives and the land is too difficult. I have no solutions. All I talk about is the Pueblos' way of seeing things. Maybe by contrast, you know, they've persisted. Their government, their religion, their philosophy, it's done so for 440 years and pretty much intact. And the message that I get very strongly is that if a people consider something as sacred as the land, as the earth, I think that people will fight for it and preserve it. And I don't know how, but, you know, that's maybe the story of means and ends. I don't know. That's all.
Well, thank you very much. I think that I described earlier, I said to Mr. Lerner and Mr. Chamberlain that they were the people representing the humanities and philosophy here, but I think that we've reached the people representing the humanities and philosophy already. Are there any questions or observations before we pass on? Ada Deer.
Yes, one short comment. My first trip to the Southwest was in 1966. I was a much younger social worker then, and I remember what one official from the Bureau of Indian Affairs told me. I told him that I was very excited to come down and see the Pueblo people and learn more about the culture and the ways and the traditions. I should say at that time I was an employee of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they sent me on this training trip for several months. I traveled around the country and got to meet many different types of Indians and to stay in the general area. At any rate, this official announced to me that it was only a matter of time before the Pueblo culture crumbled. And I said, well, that may be your perception, but I don't think that's right. Now, this was before I went down there. And I share this with you to add emphasis to the persistence and the longevity of the Pueblo people and culture. I'm sure that Pueblos will be in existence long after the bureaucracies.
I was wondering, Ralph Johnson, whether you, speaking as a law professor, want to make any observation about the definition of sovereignty that Mr. Naranjo rejected, and then the one that he found more acceptable.
Well, I think that his observation is a terribly important one. There is a misunderstood notion in the non-Indian society that sovereignty either is or is not. And I get this among my lawyer friends as well, that how can Indian tribes be sovereign? Because after all, the United States, they don't engage in treaties with the Soviet Union or whatever. And you have to explain to them that sovereignty is a variable thing. It runs on a scale from 1 to 100. And much of it depends upon how the people believe in it. But even legally, it is a highly variable thing. States are partially sovereign. They're partially subject to the control of the United States in certain things. Some Indian tribes are very sovereign, have many attributes of sovereignty, and some do not. And I think that Tito Naranjo's point that sovereignty is also in the hearts and souls of the people is a terribly important observation. I think it's an immensely important thing to realize.
Well, Tim Coulter, I think we've come to you at last, so.
One of the themes that continues to come up is this conflict or dichotomy between what the law is or what the law is thought to be and what is in the hearts and the minds of the people. And that's very much like the dichotomy between the bureaucracies and the cultures of indigenous peoples. And one of the underlying themes here seems to be, and I think it's a very appropriate one, that somehow the bureaucracies and the laws are not likely to, in the end, overcome or overwhelm the desires and the vital growth of native communities and native peoples. There's so many examples of that that I don't even want to start. I'll mention a few as I go along. I'm a member of the Potawatomi Nation, originally comes from right up near where Ada Deer is from. Moved all over the place, though. I really grew up in Oklahoma. My office is called the Indian Law Resource Center, and it's a public interest type of law office that handles cases in behalf of Indian governments, Indian peoples around the United States, but also in Central and South America, occasionally in Canada. We've ended up doing a good deal of work related to land claim matters. We're very much involved in nearly all the cases that Joe Jorgensen mentioned yesterday, the Western Shoshone case, the Seminoles in Florida, the Black Hills case, the Six Nations Confederacy in New York State. We represent the Hopi traditional leaders in Arizona, and so on. They're all involved in this same kind of struggle that the native people here are involved in. The similarities are, I have to say, the similarities are, of course, very great. It really shouldn't be very surprising to us that the similarities are great. But I think that we should also not be surprised that the similarities are tremendous between this effort, this struggle here, and what's going on in Central and South America. The basic underlying problem of the protection of indigenous cultures, indigenous resource rights, the right of native people to live as they wish to live in the face of other governments that have different designs on those resources, a different view of development and the future of humankind is a story that's essentially the same here, just as it is in Guatemala or Nicaragua or Paraguay or Brazil. The particulars may be different, but the story is essentially the same. It's a question of human rights. It's a question of moral rights, but it's also a question of law, and we can deal with it that way. I don't make an apology for being a lawyer. That's what I can offer, and I think that the law is such an immense part of the problem that I think lawyers have a very special job to do in trying to unravel it and demystify it. Well, I think that what is going on here is tremendously momentous for a number of reasons, because of the scope of the problem, because of the tremendous nature of the resource problem, the tremendous amount of land that's involved, and the tremendous number of native communities involved. And you've also embarked on a project that is tremendous, one beginning from the ground up, as I understand it, which is the process that Ada Deer has mentioned as being the one that's most likely to succeed, and I can only second that. It seems that every effort that begins in that fashion has a kind of vitality that the legal problems and the people in Washington are not able to stem. And the fact that this commission will be conducting hearings in the villages and grounding its work in the views and the aspirations of the people is its greatest strength, I'm sure. But if you're going to do a productive, useful job of evaluating ANCSA, and if you're going to come up with useful alternatives and useful strategies for dealing with the impending disaster, I realize I'm making some assumptions here, but they're assumptions I think that are widely held. If you're going to do a good job of that, I think it's going to be necessary to come to grips straight on with some overwhelming legal facts. The facts are that, as you know, really, in the United States, the law says that Congress has plenary power to do essentially as it wishes with Indian property, to do as it wishes with regard to Indian affairs, and that would apply as well, in general, to Native Alaskan property and affairs. There may be some slight distinctions and differences, but in general, this plenary power doctrine, the view that the United States Congress can do as it wishes, is an overwhelming legal fact. It, in essence, denies that Native people have the same constitutional rights and constitutional freedoms from government action that everyone else does. The doctrine suggests that Congress does not have to abide by the same limitations on its power when it deals with Native people that it must abide by when it deals with all others. In other words, Native peoples just don't have the same constitutional rights that everyone else does. As part of that plenary power doctrine, there is the more specific doctrine that Congress has the power unilaterally, without the consent of anyone, to extinguish Native property rights without just compensation, without due process of law, and without regard for the public purpose. Now, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, I don't mean to be giving you a primer here if it's not needed, but everyone else, including illegal aliens in the United States, is protected by the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Their property rights, including their possessory rights, cannot be disturbed by Congress without due process of law. That means fair procedures, a chance to go to court. can't be disturbed without just compensation, payment of fair market value. And Congress can't even do that unless it's done for a public purpose. Well, none of those restrictions apply to most native property rights. It's said that for certain Indian lands that are guaranteed in a certain way by a treaty or an act of Congress, that it may be necessary for Congress to pay just compensation. But still, the other provisions of the Fifth Amendment are not said to apply. The restriction that it be for a public purpose, the requirements of due process of law. Now, the upshot, as I already mentioned, is that native consent to the extinguishment of property rights is thus irrelevant. Doesn't matter whether native peoples, indigenous peoples, agree to give up their land rights or not. Congress can do essentially as it wishes. So although consent is legally irrelevant when it comes to extinguishing native property rights, it isn't morally irrelevant, it isn't ethically irrelevant, and it's not politically irrelevant. Congress may exercise its power to extinguish native title without regard for native consent, but we found over and over again that the question of justice, the question of morality, ever comes forward. It never seems to die. The Black Hills case is an example. Congress just took the Black Hills, terribly unjust. But the Black Hills claim is no more dead now, 100 and some odd years after the taking of the Black Hills, than it was the day after Congress did that, even though Congress has done quite a number of things to try to put that claim to rest. The Indian Claims Commission proceedings, the offer of 100 some odd million dollars to pay for the Black Hills hasn't any more settled that claim than when they took it to begin with, because everyone knows that that's not a just and moral settlement of that claim. And so even though there are these overwhelming legal facts, the continuance of the moral and ethical claims are tremendously important. And that's what I think is involved here, the refusal of native peoples to simply accept that Congress has the last word when it comes to disposing of native peoples' property rights. That just doesn't sit. It's not regarded as just. It's not regarded as right. And as a result, the claim doesn't go away. The problem doesn't go away. And it's going to continue until there is some just and some proper resolution of it. What I'm trying to get at, and I'll go into more detail, is that a just and proper resolution of native claims, native land rights, is not likely to occur unless the law is changed. It seems to me that ANCSA was passed in a setting where the power of Congress to do as it wished with native land rights was unquestioned, was essentially unquestioned. Native leaders were confronted with the proposition that Congress could, at will, without any regard for their consent, simply extinguish their land rights with nothing. And so ANCSA was, I think, regarded by many as the best that could be done under those circumstances. Reminded me of the Menominee termination matter, where the appearance of consent can only be understood in light of the overwhelming legal and political facts of that time, which were facts that, in my view, amount to a type of legal duress. Countless claims have been supposedly settled under these circumstances, settled in a setting under conditions which suggest, if they don't outright prove, that a just settlement is not taking place and that, quite the contrary, something is being imposed upon the native peoples. And I think the corollary, or to continue to reason from this proposition, suggests that you're not likely to come up with a useful resolution of this problem here. You're not likely to find a satisfactory settlement of the question of native property rights unless and until that can be done under proper legal circumstances in a setting that's perceived by native peoples and perceived by the world as fair and just. And that isn't going to take place as long as it is conceded that Congress can do as it wishes, as long as it's conceded and understood that Congress has the unilateral power to extinguish native property rights at will without regard for constitutional restrictions. I've already mentioned that this is exactly the kind of thing that happened in the Indian Claims Commission cases, where a process was started in the Indian Claims Commission to supposedly, hopefully, resolve native claims forever. But the Claims Commission perverted the mandate of the Claims Commission Act. They rather deliberately refused to carry out their mandate in a manner that was fair and just. They permitted claims to be prosecuted that they knew to be fraudulent. And that's not rhetoric. They absolutely knew, in many cases, that the lawyers before them did not represent the entities that they claimed to represent. We even have transcripts of the judges saying, we know that this entity has a government sitting somewhere, and they're not here. They nevertheless adjudicated those claims. They permitted the Black Hills claim to be adjudicated, knowing that the largest of the Sioux tribes had fired that lawyer for the express purpose of getting out of that claim. The result of that kind of fraudulent and essentially illegal procedure has been that those claims are not settled. The Indian Claims Commission can enter judgment, Congress can appropriate the money, Congress can even mail out the little green checks, and nobody thinks it's settled. They've wasted their time. It was a useless gesture, except that they've wasted a lot of money. And in many cases, I'm afraid they've muddied the water so badly that it's going to take a long time to unravel it. Well, again, I'm making some assumptions that are not really mine to make, but I've had to make them. I think that ANCSA shares many of those same problems. It was an attempt to settle something in a manner that's not going to be regarded for much longer as very fair, if it ever was regarded as fair and proper. The result is that the question is not likely to die. I wanted to offer a few remarks about how this situation came about. Why is it that we have this legal situation that is so critical? The problem, I think, is this, that originally, at least in the lower 48, relations between Indian peoples, Indian governments, and others, that is, the European powers and the United States, those relations were governed, for the most part, by treaty. It was the treaties which established the relationship and defined the respective powers and obligations of the Indian government and the United States government, or the government of Great Britain, France, Spain, the Netherlands, whatever country was involved. But after the formation of the United States, the United States Constitution was adopted, and the United States Constitution defined the relationships between the states and the federal government. It defined relationships between United States citizens and their government and their governments, but it did not say anything about the relationship between Indian governments, or Alaska Native governments for that matter, and the United States. There was nothing in the United States Constitution to take the place of or substitute for the treaty-defined relationship. And so, as the treaty relationship began to break down and eventually was abandoned, we still have a situation where there is no law, there is substantially no legal definition of the relationship between Indian governments, Native governments, and the United States government. Nothing was substituted for international law, which originally defined and governed that relationship. The U.S. Constitution says only that Congress shall regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. Well, that does not, despite what so many people have said, that does not say anything about the legal relationship between Indian governments and the United States government. It's simply one of Congress's enumerated powers. And so we came to a what I think is best understood as a legal vacuum. The United States government was in a position to do as it wished. It could arrogate to itself whatever power it wished to take, because there was no formal legal restriction or definition of what Congress's, of what the United States government's relationship was and is to Native peoples. There was an additional reason for this state of lawlessness or this legal vacuum, and that is that John Marshall, very early on in the case of McIntosh, John Marshall decided that some questions, certain kinds of questions, would not be decided by the United States courts. And in McIntosh, I think it's well to reread that, because I really disagree with the summary that was given in Dr. Jorgensen's paper. He decided that the doctrine of discovery did not give title to the United States, did not affect the Indian title to land at all. He also looked at the doctrine of conquest and determined that the international legal doctrine of conquest didn't do anything to affect native title to lands, because, for one thing, the United States seldom conquered or exercised a right of conquest with regard to Indian or native lands. Certainly up here, utterly irrelevant. I mean, there wasn't so much as a skirmish, much less any sort of conquest. But Marshall was quick to point out that the doctrine of discovery gave no right at all to the discovering nation, where those lands were already inhabited. What he did decide, though, was that the United States government had behaved as though the United States held some underlying right to the land, even though all of the right to the land was in fact vested in the original owners, the original occupants. He pointed out that the United States had patented away millions of acres of land which had never yet been acquired from the native owners, which were still entirely in the occupation of their original native owners. And what he said was, under these circumstances, the courts will not interfere. What he was saying was that in that setting, the courts will not declare what Congress has done and what the rest of the government has done to be illegal. He set aside this area and said, in this area, we're going to stay out of it. The courts are not going to enforce legal rights. He had already reviewed all of the applicable law and determined that that had no effect on the Indian right to the land. And what he came up with was what is now called, in modern day terms, the political question doctrine. He said that this kind of issue is not going to be decided by the courts. We're going to leave that to Congress and the executive branch. And that line of thinking has gone on ever since, so that the courts have not interfered when Congress has exercised this extraordinary power to do as it wished with Indian resources, to extinguish Indian title without due process and so on. Well, that contributed very much to this legal vacuum. Now the courts were out of the picture almost entirely when it came to governing or putting restrictions on what Congress does to Native peoples. We finally got to the point that in the Teton case in 1955, the Supreme Court, in a really mixed up decision, said, as we know, that Congress can extinguish Indian land rights without due process or compensation. The idea of trusteeship was gradually substituted for the legal rights that were now missing. This concept, which grew out of practically nothing, that the United States was somehow the trustee for Indian peoples and Native peoples, came to be a surrogate for or a substitute for actual enforceable legal rights. It was said that this underlying title that the United States had claimed to have, and you have to bear in mind, it was nothing more than a claim. I mean, the United States never acquired any land rights as against Indians by any tenet of international law. When the United States claims the Pine Ridge Reservation, claims to own the underlying title, they didn't acquire it through any legal means at all. There's no legal doctrine, whatever, that gave them that title. They simply claimed to have it, just made the bare assertion, and the courts have never interfered. And so the United States is said to have trust title to practically all Indian land, including land up here, as I understand it. Sure. Yeah, and would you please, I've talked too long already. I have more to say, but I'd rather discuss.
Russell Jim. Excuse me. Thank you, Tim. The question I have is in regard to the Bolt decision. And some feel, I have been advised at some time, one point or another, and in reference to your reference to the court system not interfering, someone of my learned friends has said the footnotes of the Bolt decision by the Supreme Court suggests to the legislative body how to circumvent some of the Aborigines' rights and titles, especially in regard to the fishing rights. Would you comment on that, please?
Oh, sure would. The trouble with all of these cases where there seem to be Indian victories is that they cannot, as a rule, there's some exceptions, but they cannot, in general, survive adverse congressional action. Just 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court, in the, I believe it's called the Walton case, involving the